Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Donald Warren, Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences, a national thought leader on American Indian health and addressing health disparities in underserved populations. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you. And you can also find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Please feel free to leave a review for us there. Now stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Donald Warren on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Warren, Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. A primary care physician, he's also director of InMed, Indians Into Medicine, a program designed to encourage American Indians to pursue careers in health professions. Previously, he served as chair of the Department of Public Health at North Dakota State University and a senior policy advisor to the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Health Board. He's also a senior fellow of American Indian Health Policy at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and was a nominee for U.S. Surgeon General under President Obama. He earned his MD from Stanford University and a master's in public health from Harvard. Dr. Warren, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah. And as a primary care practitioner who comes from a long line of traditional healers in the Lakota and Oglala tribe, your experience growing up on the reservation exposed you to this time-honored tradition of healing practices, but also to the daunting challenges faced by the entire communities who were marginalized and cut off from access to economic mobility and good health care. And as you entered the medical profession, you were disheartened that so much of the disease burden you faced was largely preventable. I wonder if you could help our listeners understand the prevalence of disease and poor health in American Indian populations and why they're so challenging to address.
Sure. A lot of our issues that we face in health status are rooted in poverty and marginalization and less access to basic needs in life, like good education and good food and economic opportunities. So when we look at this from a historical perspective, of course, there's been a long history of marginalization and loss of land and loss of resources. And one of the outcomes of that is less access to services, less access to even simple things like healthy food. So quite often, our people are suffering from terrible disparities related to that, including much higher rates of type 2 diabetes and its related conditions, including heart disease. We also tend to see higher rates of cancer and other chronic diseases. But unfortunately, it doesn't end there. We also have other high rates of public health issues, like even unintentional injuries and accidents. We have very high rates of death among our young people due to motor vehicle accidents, but also higher infant mortality rates. So kind of across the whole spectrum, we're dealing with disparities in maternal and child health, early child health, and then chronic disease as people get older. So one of the outcomes is that our average age at death is much younger for American Indians. In North Dakota, the average age at death for American Indians is about 54 years. Mm. So just remarkably low lifespan.
Well, Dr. Warren, I'd like to try and put it a little bit into perspective, the American Indian health narrative, into a historical context. We have to look at the foundations of the current state of disparity in Native populations that you've just described, populations whose numbers have dwindled from a high of 25 million prior to the European migration down to just a few million today. And those Native people who survived the genocide of the American Indian, the Trail of Tears, brought that collective suffering with them and have carried it over these generations. Can you talk a little bit with us about the importance of understanding the role of epigenetics and cultural trauma and the impact that has had on American Indian health?
Sure, and actually just looking at the historical numbers of indigenous peoples in the Americas and relative to the numbers today, that doesn't really tell the whole story. So when we look at estimates of the indigenous population for North America and South America, it was in the 20 to 25 million range prior to contact with Europeans. And of that number, it's estimated that probably about 5 million lived in what is now the United States. The Americas are divided up into nations that were imposed on us from Europe, not necessarily part of our own perspectives in terms of differences between what is now Canada, U.S., and Mexico. So historically, there were probably about 5 million American Indians and Alaskan Natives in what is now the United States. And by 1900, that number was actually down to less than 200,000. So from over 5 million to less than 200,000. So that was almost a complete genocide. So when we look at the numbers now, with the 2010 census, there were about 5.2 million self-identified American Indians and Alaskan Natives in the census. So our numbers have rebounded in terms of the numbers of people, but huge impact in terms of historical trauma and community-wide trauma and loss of culture, loss of resources, loss of people between initial contact and 1900. So we've seen our numbers rebound in terms of the numbers of people, but the impact is there in terms of historical trauma. And there is emerging scientific evidence in the field of epigenetics that shows that when populations undergo significant toxic stress and traumas, it can have intergenerational impact on gene expression and potentially direct impact on poor health outcomes.
You know, it was taken by longevity being in the mid-50s and certainly impacted by diabetes, depression, and alcoholism. And, you know, you've talked about the Western medicine approach to this, which are to split these conditions apart and then also split apart the medical side from the behavioral health. And really, you come at it from a different vantage point, looking at it more holistically and also in a cultural context for the American Indian population. I'm wondering if you could tell us more about that and also tell us about your medicine wheel approach as well.
Sure. When I was working as a full-time primary care physician, it was in Arizona and with one of the tribal populations that's really devastated by diabetes. In some of our populations, half the adults have type 2 diabetes. It really is a remarkable disparity that we see right in Indian country, right in the middle of this nation. And what I see among many people with diabetes, whether they're American Indian or not, is high rates of depression. It's actually so prevalent, I think we should be considering depression a complication of diabetes because it is so common. Now, not everyone with diabetes gets depression, but not everyone with diabetes gets kidney failure either. So I think depression's common enough, it really should be considered a complication. And in this nation, the most common self-medication for depression is alcohol intake. So what I see is a lot of people with diabetes who are self-medicating their depression with alcohol intake, and the alcohol intake actually makes the blood sugar worse and makes the depression worse, which leads to even more alcohol intake. So I see this vicious cycle of diabetes, depression, and alcohol intake, and it really is a syndrome. I've seen it in hundreds of patients and in thousands of patient visits, but we don't treat it systemically or holistically. We treat each individual condition individually, and we tend to look at diabetes management and outpatient depression management as a medical issue. But if someone has major depression and alcohol dependence, then we see that as a behavioral health issue. So we essentially cut the patient in half and say that the medical side will do its part, the behavioral health side will do its part, but we don't really collectively address this from a holistic perspective. And that's very contrary to what we would do traditionally. And what I was taught in traditional Lakota approaches to health was that we would never look at this in just individual parts. We'd look at the whole and recognize it holistically. What's happening here is there's certainly physical illness, but there's also emotional, spiritual, and mental imbalance that needs to be addressed. So if we were to be intelligent as a health system, we would address it from the perspective of how the patient is experiencing the disease processes. And I think that's one area where traditional medicine has much to teach us in modern scientific medicine.
Well, Dr. Warren, I know that you were being considered by the previous administration for the post of U.S. Surgeon General and Had you been chosen, you said you would have used that platform as a chance to highlight the underfunded and under-resourced Indian Health Service. The current administration has stated publicly that they'd like to see even more cuts to the Indian Health Services, as well as cuts to the Medicaid expansion, which you've noted is the single most effective policy in decades to advance the health of the American Indian population. Talk with us about the challenges within the Indian Health Services and what solutions you envision to address this significant gap in resources and the degree to which the Indian Health Service is embracing this model of a fully holistic approach.
In the United States, people are not born with a legal right to health services, except American Indians. We're actually the only population born with a legal right to health services. And that's based on the many hundreds of treaties that were signed between tribal nations and the federal government. And essentially, the tribes exchanged land and natural resources for various social services like health, education, and housing. So that's why there's a Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's why there's an Indian Health Service. So the land that is now the United States was not lost in a war. It was actually exchanged through treaties. And treaties are the highest order of law in the land. There's even a treaty clause in the U.S. Constitution that states that treaties are the highest order of law. So we have hundreds of treaties between tribal nations and the federal government. And most of the treaties have some sort of component of health care included. Some of the common language was promise of all proper care and protection. And certainly, as American Indians, we have not received all proper care and protection. So in a very basic way, if you look at these treaties as contracts between tribal nations and the U.S. government, the U.S. government is in breach of contract because they have not held up their end of the bargain. So Indian Health Service, for many, many decades now, has been funded at about 40 to 50% of actual need. So we have inadequate resources to provide all proper care and protection as lined out in our treaties. And one of the programs that did help a lot is Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Of course, not every state expanded Medicaid. But if you look at access to health services comparing North Dakota and South Dakota, where North Dakota we expanded Medicaid, South Dakota we did not, we have much better access to health services and resources. I think Indian Health Service does its best with its limited resources to try to address things holistically. Even their mission looks at building emotional and spiritual health to the highest level possible. The challenge is we just don't have the resources to fully invest in protecting health of American Indians. And that really is the fault of Congress. They should be pointing the fingers at themselves for underfunding this whole program for now for decades.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Warren, Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. He's also Director of InMed Indians Into Medicine, a program designed to encourage American Indians to pursue careers in the health profession. Dr. Warren, we recently had North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum on the show talking about the state's effort to confront addiction. And you participated in the Governor's Day of Prevention, and you said to get to solutions to our addiction dilemma, you have to walk through truth. Tell us more about walking through truth and some of the public health partnerships that are needed to help the American Indian communities get the help they desperately need.
As a nation, we need to come to terms with the American Holocaust, and that's exactly what it was. And the American Indian population was almost completely wiped out. And some of the tribes have completely disappeared because of deliberate efforts to kill American Indians. And the challenge there is that we don't see a lot of this in our history books because it's unpleasant. But if we are ever going to get to health equity, where we can actually raise health to appropriate status for every population, we have to contend with the truth. And I see a reluctance to do that because it makes people feel bad. And the truth is, there was deliberate attempt at genocide of American Indians. People may have heard of Amherst, Massachusetts, or Amherst College. It's named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who was a colonial governor in the colonies. And he is the one who ordered the distribution of blankets from a smallpox hospital to the northeastern tribes with the purpose of killing them. So our first documented case of bioterrorism is our own colonial government. Yeah. But that's not taught in our history books. It's remarkable how often I share that story and people are in shock, had no idea. But that's a part of our truth. And I think that if we don't understand the truth of history, what I see is that people blame the victims. They don't understand why we have such high rates of poverty. They don't understand why we have such high rates of addiction or diabetes or cancer. Well, there are reasons for this, but they are unpleasant reasons. And what I see is a reluctance to embrace the truth because people don't like it. Well, from my perspective, if you want to get to equity, you have to walk through truth, even when it's unpleasant. In terms of partnerships, we do have to work with not just the federal government, but also with our states, with Medicaid programs, with private sector agencies. And one of our challenges historically is that we have smaller numbers than other populations. We are the minority of the minority populations. And we are very underrepresented in leadership positions and in policymaking positions. As an example, the Congressional Black Caucus is comprised of primarily African Americans. For American Indians, there's nobody in the Senate, for example. We have zero American Indian senators. So at the highest level of lawmaking and policymaking, we're underrepresented. So we have to have partnerships with non-Indian populations to improve policymaking and lawmaking around access to health services. So that's something we're working on. There's a lot of national and regional agencies that are trying to improve this. But I think one of our challenges, again, with the lack of appropriate and accurate truth-telling in history, most people are unaware of these issues. So we're kind of out of sight, out of mind, and that's adding to the disparity.
Well, Dr. Warren, I really appreciate that you're tackling health inequities in one way by developing programs that enhance public health best practices with culturally relevant strategies. You're building a curriculum around that at the North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. You're encouraging through InMed American Indians to pursue careers in the health professions so they can advance their own careers, but also care for their home communities and significantly impact population health within their tribes. Talk with us about your approach to training the next generation of healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, midwives, PAs, healers in the American Indian community. And what's unique about your approach and what are you seeing in terms of success?
Well, it's a significant challenge because when we want to build the next generation of health professionals, we have to recognize we have a limited pool because of high rates of high school dropout. Yep. So much of our work is also focused on building the pipeline of potential future health leaders from our communities, because if we have less high school graduates, we'll have less college students and therefore less potential medical students. So we're working on building the pipeline. Actually, right now we have our InMed Summer Institute going on. We have currently 45 students from across the nation who are American Indian high school and middle school students here at University of North Dakota for 6 weeks. And we expose them to all kinds of opportunities in health careers, and they get to actually have a cohort of colleagues who are from similar backgrounds. Even if they had never met before, they get to come together and realize that they're not the only ones who are American Indian who are interested in health careers. Right. So there's a lot of power in having cohorts of people or groups of people that are trying to work toward a similar goal. I think if you're from the majority population, you don't really recognize the impact of role models, because if you grow up and all of your teachers, all of your doctors that you've ever seen are from your race, then anything seems possible. You know, it wasn't until I was in college until I finally met an American Indian physician. And the disparities and the shortages of American Indian health professionals are just tremendous. So that's really part of my goal now, is to try to reverse that. Another one of our challenges is that we don't have enough American Indian medical faculty members. Around the nation, the Association of American Medical Colleges does keep track of race and ethnicity for faculty members. And there's different ranking of professors of medicine. In the United States, there are over 37,000 professors of medicine. Of that number, 10 are American Indian.
That's 10 powerful.
Out of 37,000. Yeah. So just the need for building role models and leaders within academic health institutions is just tremendous. And the disparities are almost laughably ridiculous. So we're going to do our part to try to reverse that.
Well, we always also like to look on the other side, and the public health community should keep an eye on You clearly are a success story, but who do you look for as role models? It seems like the population has grown. Can I assume it's a younger population? How, in other ways, are you describing the successes to young American Indians who are looking for careers, looking to role models like yourself? Who else stands out, and what are you seeing that excites you about the population in terms of accomplishments that happen?
Yeah, we do have a very young population. In addition to high rates of death, we also have high rates of birth. So the result is we have a very young population of American Indians and Alaskan Natives. And I'm very encouraged about this current generation. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a reawakening of cultural connectedness, but also this younger generation wanting to do more for their communities, mm-hmm. much more social activism, much more inclusiveness. And another thing I find encouraging is that the younger generation of millennials here in the United States, I don't see the same degree of racism. Mm-hmm. I see much more acceptance. And I think this current generation that's now turning 18 is the most diverse generation that we've ever had in this nation. And this generation moving forward feels like it's much more tolerant of others than previous generations. So I feel good about the future. And what I'm hoping we can do is build upon that and recognize that as American Indians, but also as members of this nation, we should all be in this together. We should be working toward building equity for all populations. And I see a lot of that energy within our young students right now. I'm very encouraged about the future, and I believe that as the seventh generation of survivors from Wounded Knee and other terrible outcomes, I see hope for the future in their energy.
You know, Dr. Warren, I have to ask you a timely question, which is really about your knowledge and expertise and experience as then applied to what we need to learn for all people. And I wonder, given the historical experience of the separation of so many Native American families from their children as they were sent to boarding schools and the like, as you look at our current situation at the border with the separation of parents and children, whether you have any advice or comment for the country on the potential long-term impact of that?
Yeah, this is certainly a stark example of adverse childhood experiences, and we know that adverse childhood experiences correlate to poor health outcomes for adults. Yeah. So the worse the experiences are in childhood, the worse the health status is as people get older. And it's just remarkable to me that we're allowing this to happen. But again, it's an older generation of people who dehumanize others. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in this country, there's been a long history of that. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think that the millennial generation is on board with the type of policymakers who would take children away from families. I don't think they're that hateful in the younger generation. Mm-hmm. But we have what we have right now, so we all need to collectively recognize that this is wrong. It's certainly, they try to quote the Bible, it's certainly not Christian. It's horrific circumstances, and we are going to harm that entire generation mm-hmm. of children who are just simply seeking safety.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Dr. Donald Warren, Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and Senior Fellow of American Indian Health Policy at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You can learn more about his work by going to med.und.edu, or you can follow him on Twitter at Donald Warren MD. Warren is spelled W-A-R-N-E. Dr. Warren, thank you so much for your work, your dedication to addressing health disparities, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I appreciate being a part of the conversation.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We saw heated rhetoric on both sides of the aisle when House Republicans pursued a bill that would expand work requirements for the food stamp program. Let's look at the facts on the program and the proposed changes, which are part of the Farm Bill. In February, the most recent month for which we have figures, 40 million people received food stamp benefits. Those are now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. That figure is from the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service. The GOP proposed work requirements would cause 1.2 million fewer people a month to access the benefits by 2028. Under current SNAP rules, able-bodied adults between the ages of 18 and 49 and without dependents are required to work at least 20 hours a week or participate in a qualified job training or volunteer program in order to be eligible for more than 3 months of benefits over a three-year period. Benefits are cut off after 3 months if the work requirements are not met. The proposed GOP law would raise the age of those subject to the work requirement from 49 to 59 and extend the work requirements to adults with children ages 6 and older. The minimum work required would rise to 25 hours per week in 2026. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 62% of those who would lose benefits would be able-bodied adults caring for children 6 or older. Another 27% would be able-bodied adults between the ages of 50 and 59 without dependents. Another proposed change in the bill would cut off SNAP eligibility for those whose gross income exceeds 130% of poverty instead of the 200% threshold for SNAP recipients in some states. That would cause another 400,000 households per year to lose eligibility. According to the USDA, 3.5 million SNAP participants in fiscal 2016 were non-disabled adults living in a household without children, and about 30% of them were working. The bill failed in the House in May, but Congress is expected to take up such legislation again. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. According to statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Native Americans are 60% more likely to suffer from diabetes, obesity, and a sedentary lifestyle. But inspiring change in these cultures with conventional approaches, that's proven to be a challenge. A tribe in northern Idaho may have found a workable solution right in their own backyard. Leaders on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation have created a fitness program called Powwow Sweat, an exercise program comprised of a series of their traditional dances performed to traditional drumming and music.
Hello, my friends and relatives. My name is Shadeja, and in this segment, we will be learning movements from the women's traditional dance category. 8 basic steps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Lavina Louis is the director of the tribe's wellness center and says the Powwow Sweat Fitness Program brings an often underutilized component of more broadly deployed wellness approaches, the tribe's own cultural heritage. And she says it carries a lot of potential for ongoing motivation.
If you don't do it regularly, your calves will hurt. It's almost like jump roping for 25 minutes straight.
It's a lot more attractive than doing jogging or the bicycle because it also relates to my culture and my people.
Ryan Ortevez speaking to local reporter Emily Schwing. The Coeur d'Alene tribe has received a grant from the CDC to not only develop and expand the Powwow Sweat exercise program, but also to build a large communal organic garden, incorporating a community-wide approach to wellness. In the ensuing months since the program launched, a number of participants like Ryan Ortevez have begun to incorporate other healthy habits, such as quitting smoking and losing weight.
I'm aiming to lose 40 pounds by the end of the year.
The Powwow Sweat workouts break down a half dozen traditional dances into a series of repetitive moves designed to build up endurance over time, as well as preparing the tribal members to partake in the summer's upcoming powwow, a community-based, culturally relevant fitness program that incorporates cultural traditions into the process of achieving health and wellness goals, leading to greater success.
Drop the Pringles and let's jingle. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University. streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.